the state of the art on this. That in particular moments, a middle class can take a certain form, have a certain relationship to the state, produce a certain developmental trajectory. So at times, maybe smallholders are part of the middle class. But that's a historically constructed boundaries of the, you know, sometimes smallholders align with the working class, and you get the red-green Scandinavian alliance, or you get social democracy in the periphery, which is the title of a book I recently wrote with some co-authors, where the smallholders are not middle class. They become the social base for social democracy aligned with the working class as part of left programmatic formation. So there's that big macro historical analysis. And here, to respond a bit to Eva, you know, I mean, yeah, the middle class historically has been fickle. It has aligned with pro-democracy movements. By the way, Gregory Lubert's book, I think, is the state of the art on this. And he shows the different alliances of the urban middle class with different rural fractions producing different outcomes, fascism, liberalism, social democracy. It's a wonderful book. And it's that kind of classic sort of Barrington-Morian big macro class formation analysis. And that's terrific. But to do that right, you need about 100 years of history. And right now we've got this new phenomenon, this new middle class, this new thing called globalization. And so we're having a really hard time figuring out what the hell this middle class is, because it's not formed. It's in formation, right? And it's complex and it's heterogeneous. And so, you know, I would argue then for taking a more meso-level Bourdieu perspective and looking at actual practices, right? And Devesh's focus on professions, I think, is one of the ways of doing that. And so what kind of analytic categories can we draw on when we do this kind of analysis? And I'd say the key one is really how the boundaries are patrolled. I mean, this is ultimately about, you know, Weber, it's not so much that Weber had a theory of class consumption, he had a theory of status closure, how you enclose the group, how you define it, how you patrol the boundaries, define those boundaries, et cetera. There's a material dimension to this, you know, and the material dimension is hoarding opportunities. I mean, this is what these class fractions do, right? They try to render a particular asset, a credential, a property, a mode of access, a set of networks relatively scarce. And in making it scarce, of course, they increase the returns. So there's all sorts of strategies. One, and this is what Bourdieu talked about, the classification struggles, credentialization, who becomes a doctor and who doesn't become a doctor, midwives versus doctors, et cetera. And then there's all these, this idea of conversion strategies, and a number of you made reference to this. But I think this is a profoundly important sociological insight. There's not one capital, there are multiple capitals. And especially in moments of transition, and globalization is clearly a mega moment of transition, what we need to be paying attention to are what these conversion strategies look like. So the Indian middle classes don't have a lot of capital, but they have a lot of cultural capital, they have a lot of political capital, and they're now translating it into economic capital, as well as investing in new forms of cultural capital, et cetera. And it seems to me those conversion strategies, what they look like, where they take place, is a really critical site of research. And then I just want to throw this in to add to what Rocco was saying. You know, there are these material strategies, but these material strategies are deeply linked to cultural strategies. You know, Bourdieu was emphatic that we should not disconnect the micro from the macro. So the way in which distinctions are produced in the home, in the private sphere, then spills over into the public sphere. And I just pulled out this quote from Bourdieu that, for me, sort of captures the wonderful ethnography Rocco gave us yesterday. You know, what is a class? You know, it's not just its self-proclaimed political positions, the manifesto of a political party. It's also the unconscious, you know, and he has there's this quote, this is from Distinctions, an immediate adherence at the deepest level of the habitus to the tastes, the distaste, sympathies and aversions, fantasies and phobias, which more than declared opinions forge the unconscious unity of a class. So when the housewife doesn't allow the servant to sit on the couch, right? That is a class phobia that reproduces the cultural distinction. All right, so we've talked a lot about how, you know, maybe this is a new epoch and giving new significance to this middle class, and I just thought it'd be useful to very quickly identify what it is about the new economy, call it post-Fordist, call it information, call it service sector, post-industrial, post-modernist, whatever post you want. But there's something new going on here, and there's a number of elements. One is decentralized global production, right? So production now, automobiles are made in 50 different places, and the parts are assembled in one place. So you need deeply coordinated commodity chains, right? There's a new organizational complexity to how capital and products move around the world. There's a niche production. George talked about this yesterday, right? We don't have a single global mass market. We have niche production. It's all about creating new identities. So, you know, post-industrialism and postmodernism go very well together, right? This is the sort of cultural moment of capitalism. And the emphasis here is not so much on production, it's on differentiation. It's on creating distinction. And the key assets there are really design, innovation, and branding. It's all about the brand, right? And then there's this whole logic of commodifying knowledge, whether it's information technologies, entertainment, or biotech. A lot of money is being invested not so much into the technologies as into the property rights, the intellectual property rights, through which you secure the returns, the rents on these technologies. And then to add to all of this, to make all of this work in this new globally interconnected economy, you need a massive service sector infrastructure, right? I mean, so for every knowledge producer, you need a guy who makes sushi, right? You need a new specialized services to satisfy the postmodern niche consumption habits of this new global middle class of knowledge workers. So all of this really creates a massive premium, and a really massive premium for knowledge workers, right? The whole range of professionals, experts, those who have specialized knowledge of these new fields, as well as the complex systems managers, right? So that's sort of high-end, we'll call them bureaucrats, right? But high-end bureaucrats who know how to run these global commodity chains are really in a command position. And so we're reminded, of course, that 64% of the Indian economy today is service sector, right? I mean, we've never seen this before. And globally, that's also true. So let me quickly move on to the role of the state. We've talked a lot about it, but I just want to emphasize that there's really been two distinct phases. In the ISI phase, the state created the middle class, especially in India. We heard about this yesterday in India and South Africa, certainly in China, certainly in South Korea. I mean, the middle class is an artifact of state activity, right? And that's changing a bit now, obviously, because the global economy is offering this new middle class of knowledge workers and professionals new opportunities. So they've disinvested themselves from the traditional state, the traditional ISI, big subsidy, public sector state. They've opted out of public education, thereby lowering the value of credentials from the public sector, a sort of classic repositioning strategy in the Bourdieu sense. But what's interesting is that this is not a retreat of the state. I mean, we tend to think of it, oh, it's the triumph of markets and neoliberalism and the state is being downsized. And that's not at all true. I think the South Africa case is really good here. I mean, obviously, the state is still very much the key field of power. It's still providing all sorts of subsidies. So black economic empowerment is the obvious one, you know, literally creating a set of selective rents to welcome people with social capital who can then translate that into sources of sources of income. But the state's also key in enforcing classifications. And the important thing to remember is that in a knowledge economy, it's very hard to define value. It's very hard to define the actual characteristics of a commodity. And so the returns on investment are really a function on how the knowledge is classified, the property relations, the credentials, et cetera. And Devesh was making this point yesterday. In India, it's not all the colleges and universities that matter. It's really the ones at the very top, because those are the ones that secure the highest returns on investment in education. And a related point that I wanted to make, because this came up a bunch of times yesterday, is the role of the middle class in civil society. And again, using the example of South Africa, although I think it's true in India as well, I would argue that what we're seeing is this bifurcation of civil society. So on the one hand, you have, in the South African case, I mean, the line is really clear. You have professional NGOs, you have well-organized interest groups, all of which have routinized forms of engagement with the state. They have access, they contract for all sorts of services. These are clearly middle-class actors. Many of them are reinvented apartheid-era bureaucrats who left saw the writing on the wall, left the bureaucracy, reinvented themselves as consultants and experts. And they're selling their services to the state, and it's perfectly legal. So I call this, you know, contractual patronage. It's clearly patronage, but it is contractual. You know, it's by the law, by the books, et cetera. But you've got to know how to play the rules, of course, and that's the key asset that the middle class has. But then you have a whole other civil society sector in South Africa, the civics, the township associations, the land right groups. The 5,000 organizations that protested service delivery in 2005, they have no place to go. They have no points of contact with the state. They have no way of engaging with it. So you're getting this deep bifurcation of civil society. Ideologies come up a few times. So again, a few very eclectic, scattered comments. This is a quote from Bourdieu: "Ideology is an illusion, but consistent with interest, a well-grounded illusion." The article that I did with Lila Fernandez was called "Hegemonic Aspirations," and we wanted to emphasize, and in the Gramscian sense, you know, what is hegemony? It's when a class fraction projects itself as being who its interests are the general interests of all, right? That's a sort of standard hegemonic move. And the bourgeoisie can't really make it because it's so obviously self-interested, right? So it's really the middle class that tends to be the producer of the ideology of the ruling bloc. So in the Indian or the South African context, the various ideologies of how market forces are going to bring development and social justice, et cetera. And there's really two elements here. One is naturalizing the market. So all the things that we're seeing are positive things, are the natural effects of people working hard, returns to effort and ability, and the market rewards people for their merit and their effort. But it's accompanied by this misrecognition of the social, right? So you get South African ANC elite saying, "I'm rich because I worked hard for this." No, you're rich because you're politically connected, right? And we're still seeing very sort of class-specific patterns of upward mobility in India. And there is this almost organized denial, unwillingness to deal with the issues of inequality, the issues of caste in India, the issue of race, or more specifically political connection in South Africa. This also gets politicized, and I'd argue that in its more reactionary moments, the ideological affinity of the middle class is always towards nationalism, because nationalism emphasizes unity in the context of disunity, and you generate these discourses that, you know, we're all South African, we're all Indian, and yet, of course, there are these deep social divisions. And this is why we can find, you know, an affinity, there's a clear affinity between the urban middle class in India and the rise of Hindutva. And as many people have pointed out, but Hansen in particular, it's not so much that the urban middle class, which is a globalizing, cosmopolitizing, liberalizing social class, it's not that they have real affinities for, say, Hindu conservatism, but they do have the affinities for the values of Hindutva that emphasize stability, order, and hierarchy in the context of rapid transformation, right? Hence this quote from Hansen. And there's a parallel in South Africa that I find fascinating, and it's what Kulela Nkomanku calls racial nativism. So increasingly, the ANC has been using a discourse of what he calls racial nativism. That is, if you're not loyal to the ANC, if you're not loyal to the project of the National Democratic Revolution, you're either a racist or a counter-revolutionary, right? And so the increasingly loyalty is not to the Constitution, it's not to the idea of South African citizenship, it's to the idea of a racial nativism, an essentialized identity. Much like Hindutva is this idea that all Indians should somehow be loyal to this identity of being Hindus. But what I want to emphasize here is that there are real limits to this hegemonic project. Hegemonic projects work if they're materially coordinated. I mean, people use the word hegemony all the time, but always forget that Gramsci said hegemony works if it's materially coordinated with the interests of the subordinate class. And what's interesting is that if you think of the classic bourgeoisie, it did coordinate its interests with the working class because it needed the working class, right? You need the workers, they got to go to the factories, and hence the whole literature on class compromise, and it's a real distributive compromise. But the new middle class is more globally, people in Sandton care more, Sandton is the new sort of greenfield development in Johannesburg, people in Sandton care more about what's going on in New York than in Soweto. The only thing they need from Soweto is domestics. They don't need workers, because they're knowledge workers. They work in these global networks. They have no investment. They have no material need to coordinate with subordinate groups in South Africa. And I'd argue very much the same thing in India. The middle class has no material need to really coordinate its class interests with subordinate groups. It's more interested in the global economy and those networks and those flows of commodities and rents than it is in investing in the local economy. So unlike the classic bourgeoisie of the industrial era, which eventually, after multiple working class struggles, did compromise and did find positive sum deals to make with the working class, hence the rise of the social welfare state, et cetera, there's, in my mind at least, no obvious way of concretely coordinating the class interests of the middle class with subordinate groups. And so in India, what we're seeing, instead of any kind of distributional equilibrium, any effort to build linkages between classes, we're just seeing this sort of rampant patronage polity that's developing. And in South Africa, Class polarization is actually increasing. Inequality is increasing. The distance between the formal and the informal sector is increasing. But political unity has been achieved through the politics of racial compromise, right? Which are concretized at the higher ends by deracializing capital and deracializing market access. Finally, I want to make a quick point about retreat from politics, and then if I have time, show you a map. Yeah. We've talked a lot about the role of the middle class in politics, and there's often an assumption that at least in well-established, I'm only talking about democratic orders, that the working class, the middle class withdraws from political activity, and there's certainly evidence of that in India. I haven't seen the poll results for South Africa, but I'd actually be surprised that the working class, the middle class votes less than other classes, but there are some anti-politics of the middle class I think we need to talk about. First, there's this plebeianization. So, the middle class, I mean, the media, the key institutions of cultural and symbolic production are essentially middle class institutions. And they have been increasingly constructing politics as this really dirty, nasty, plebeian arena, right? And Atul turned to me yesterday when Gay was talking about Zuma and said, Zuma is South Africa's Mayawati. And I think that's right. I mean, the middle class loves to portray these populist political actors as crude, as corrupt, as polluting the political arena, right? And again, the sort of middle class idea of virtue. There's a real tension, and this is especially pronounced in South Africa, between middle class support for representative formal democracy, which works to their advantage, and participatory democracy. And we, Devesh and I talked about this a bit yesterday. And the middle class is really afraid of masses in the streets, masses participating. So there's a lot of this law and order rhetoric. And I think one of the reasons the urban middle class in India has been supporting the BJP as much as it has, despite the obvious non-affinities in ideological terms, is that the BJP presents itself as a party of order. And this is sort of a classic form of middle class reaction. And then the other dimension of this is the emphasis on technocracy. And again, maybe less pronounced in India, but in South Africa, the solution to every problem has become the consultant. Right? So instead of negotiating, instead of involving citizens, you bring in consultants. It's increasingly top-down. It's this kind of new managerialism. And again, this is a realm of middle-class monopoly and privilege, and they're getting all the contracts, et cetera. And poverty has been reduced essentially to a policy question. Right, so policy is this residual from apartheid. But if we get the policies right, we can do away with poverty. And then two more points, but I've already made these, so I'll skip over them very briefly. Namely, that this liberal class, this class that represents itself as the carriers, the modern conveyors of liberalism, market liberalism, is also deeply illiberal in many of these contexts. On the one hand, it supports these ideological constructions of universalism, inclusion, meritocracy. On the other hand, it's really hard at work in its daily practices of enforcing social hierarchy and attaching itself to these conservative values of order and purity. All right. How much time do I have? I'm pushing it. Okay, so just some quick. I'm going to focus on Joburg because Gay knows Joburg, and so she can comment on these maps too. But it's the quintessential global city. Its slogan is a world class city, and the activists always ask, no, we just want a nice city. No, but the emphasis is a world class city, right? So these are the basic demographic distributions: 3 million people now, 74% 2001. This is all census data. Are African, 16% are white. This is the distribution of Africans through Johannesburg, and I wish I had a clicker or something. But so this is, of course, the great mining town. All the mines are here, right? And so all the townships are south of the mines, and all the nice leafy neighborhoods are north. That new one up there is basically a refugee camp for Zimbabweans, Deep Slut, the big one. This is downtown, which, as you can see, has become almost exclusively black. This is the township of Soweto. And up there is Alexandra, the other big township. And the north is all greenfield development. It's all brand new. It's all a function of white flight from, Midrand, up to Midrand. Yeah, Sandton, they literally moved the stock market from downtown Johannesburg to Sandton, just fleeing the downtown. Right? So it's a sort of classic American-style pattern of the white flight into northern greenfield suburbs. And it's actually concentrating a bit. So this is 96, and this is 2001. This is where whites live. You know, it's a very clear pattern, all in the northern suburbs and concentrating a bit. This is cluster analysis, and I won't go into the details, but basically it measures the extent to which any given neighborhood looks like the neighborhood next to it. Right? So it's a spatial statistical measure, and it gives you a better, literally, picture of concentrations, right? And so you see a growing concentration of whites in particular in that large blue cluster. But I'll skip over. This is medium income, and predictably, it more or less tracks race. This is percentage below medium income. This is what I want to get to. So this is the occupational structure of Johannesburg. Sort of standard census categories. Remember, this is only 5 years of change. They did a census in 96 and then 2001. The next one, unfortunately, is not until 2011. But I love the fact they have this category of legislators, senior officials, and managers, in other words, the state. And then there's these other categories, and we can sort of debate which ones we want to call middle class and which ones we don't want to call middle class. But one of the things I did with my graduate students is just calculate the index of dissimilarity. And again, I won't go into the details, but this measures the resident, the spatial concentration of a particular occupational group, right? Now, the average, and this is on a scale of 0 to 1, 1 would mean it's perfectly segregated. 0 would mean it's perfectly not segregated or desegregated. Paris, I know, is 0.12, just to give you one point of reference, right? So very little occupational segregation. And look at these numbers. The highest, with the exception of the agriculture and fishing, we should just get rid of that because there's, I don't know who fishes still in Johannesburg, but whatever. These are the two categories. These are the upper ends of the middle class, obviously. These are the most occupationally segregated. It's not surprising. And the segregation, at least in this category, is increasing quite dramatically. So what are the actual spatial patterns of all this? And this, I can't wait to go to Joburg and show this to municipal officials and ANC guys, because the single most acute pattern of concentration are the state and ANC officials. They are clustering into, and these up here, these are all gated communities. And it's not just that the community is gated and access is limited to residents. It's that the houses themselves are then fortified with electric wiring, private security, et cetera. So this is a very deep form of retrenchment and disconnection from Soweto. Again, remember that Soweto is here. So you're getting this high concentration in the new northern suburbs. By the way, all of this activity in the north in particular is being driven entirely by developers. And they are so powerful that the city of Johannesburg, which by any third world standards is a high capacity, well-resourced state, can't control the developers. And they are building one gated community after another. It's literally kilometers and kilometers of greenfield development of gated communities. And this is where the elites of the state are entrenching themselves. And you're seeing what you're seeing, and this is the Julius Wilson problem, is an outflow of professionals from Soweto. So this is Soweto, right? And there's some areas of Soweto that are quite nice. Deep Kloof, for example, very nice neighborhood with trees and three-story villas. But professionals, the higher-end categories, at least, are moving out of Soweto. So depleting Soweto of that kind of social capital, again, in the Julius Wilson sense of the term, not entirely surprising. On the other hand, technicians and associate professions, and this would include nurses and teachers, which are the single biggest public sector categories, there you're seeing an increase in Soweto. Right? So you're getting quite a bit of class differentiation within Soweto itself, except that the higher ends of the middle class are moving out, and they're moving out into the nicer white suburbs. But these folks, for the most part, really just can't afford the property prices in the northern suburbs, so they're staying put in Soweto. And I think that's my last slide. And then clerks, again, not surprisingly, are concentrating in Soweto and around Alex. And am I out of time? So I'll leave you with this Bourdieu quote, because there was a lot of discussion yesterday about, you know, how is it under the conditions of modernity when the obvious mechanisms of selection and exclusion, like caste or traditional conceptions of gender, are gone. How do we still manage, even in the great French Republic, with its all social benefits, to systematically reproduce inequality from generation to generation? And this is one of Bourdieu's I think, many telling examples of how we do that, the various selection mechanisms. And I'll stop there. I do have more maps, though.
I'm sort of stunned at how beautifully this panel did with what we wanted to in raising what I think in different ways are how, questions about how you define the middle class, how that definition leads you to think about what political interests might be, and how you think about the middle class in relation to political projects and kind of coalitions and processes. So I think I want to just open, I actually could ask some questions of each of you, but maybe I'll open it up and not a few questions.
Thank you. I think it's a wonderful panel. I think, you know, that panel brings the issue to sort of, you know, to focus in a very interesting way, because this is something that we struggle with all the time. We have three perspectives, right? Quite analytical, parsimonious one, which Eva represents, and then sort of, you know, practical one and engaged one from the policy point of view with Noah's paper. And then, you know, there comes sociologists who complicates everything to such a degree that almost, you know, we lose capacity to really come up with sort of general kind of ideas because life is so complex and travels on so many different levels that... So you know, this is just perfect for the end of the conference. Now, I have two points I would like to make. I think Ralph Dahrendorf many years ago had this idea coming from Marxist tradition that what we have in traditional capitalist societies are those class dependencies. Right, so you know, bourgeois needs the working class, and so on and so on. Now he says, well, the change which we see is that suddenly those dependencies are no longer with us. Right, so there's this underclass no one needs, and the question is, do we want the state just to control that underclass so they don't, you know, explode the society with crime and everything, and then. If we do it, who is going to pay for it, right? Can we have consensus on this issue? Now, so the class dependencies are gone. Now, I think this is a little bit reflection of the point I was making yesterday about the multiple exit options, right? Because, you know, that's exactly what is going on if you look from that perspective, that the members, different fragments of classes are not really dependent anymore on their domestic context. They can sort of move, they have identities that are plugged into global processes and so on. Now, the question for me, which sort of, you know, goes to the papers, that's the first one, is what about those informal sectors, those you know, pieces of sovereignty which were surrendered to other bodies, right? You think about European Union, you know, Brussels is controlling what states used to do to a great extent, and you think about international bodies of different sort, which sort of, you know, the states are surrendering the pieces of sovereignty to those organizations. And then on the other hand, you see that gigantic informal sector emerging, which both transnational and national. And I wonder what that does to middle class, right? And the relationship and the economy. Now, the second point I wanted to make is that, yes, we see gigantic change taking place in front of our eyes, but again, I think that, you know, we should not exaggerate and think simplistically about the past 100 years or 200 years, right? Because, you know, we tend to have this sort of analytical shortcuts, which we absorb from the literature we are forced to read and in the introductory courses, and then we have this incredibly simple view of what was going on in you know, English industrialization process or French bourgeois political developments, and then suddenly, you know, there's this new complex life which is puzzling. Now, I think, you know, part of the problem in defining this, I didn't show that slide yesterday, but part of the problem of defining middle class is that that we took only part of the German discussion about this. We took from Hegel and Marx the bürgerliche Gesellschaft concept, which is, you know, petit bourgeois, right? This bourgeois middle class. But in the German discussion, they had this Bildungsbürgertum concept, which is educated middle class. And when you look at the German city, right, you have bürgerliche Gesellschaft, you know, the shopkeepers and so on, and you have the Bildungsbürgertum, a teacher, the priest, and these are the people who drive politics, right? This is not, you know, this is not the petty bourgeois who drives the city politics. These are the educated class. And this is 19th century Germany. So, you know, we see that pretty much in today, right? That's exactly where the biggest tensions are. And you know, the state, the bürgerliche Gesellschaft, and then Bildungsbürgertum, and then, you know, now we have this under informal sector. So I think, you know, that's the point I want to really sort of emphasize. We really need to look carefully at what was going on in different places in the past, because some of those processes are a bit more different, more complicated, and so on, but still. So. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, I should stop.
Okay, so I see there's two figures, but Rafa, did you want to jump in on this?
No, I have a question.
Okay.
I don't want two fingers.
Oh, okay.
I just have a question.
Okay, so Rafa and Amani, we'll get there.
Left his phone, I think. Left his phone, I went to left his phone. Your phone kept ringing. the Tocqueville's idea of the relationship between middle class and democracy in America was far simpler than Lipset's. He simply believed that the middle class was a class that would moderate between the greed of the rich and the extreme poverty of the poor. And that, combined with the possibility of upward mobility, made everybody sort of happy, and eventually a classless society, hence, this was all good for democracy. So this was sort of Tocqueville's idea. There was a specific characteristic of the middle class. It was in the middle, mediated between the rich and the poor. Okay. But of India, political scientist Yogendra Yadav says that the middle class is not a sociological category in India. It is a proper noun. It is the name the ruling class gives to itself. Mm-hmm. Right? So if that is true, I guess my question is sort of actually to Patrick, because one of the things that you raised was you kept talking about the middle class's affinity to security, stability, and law and order projects, which gives it its sort of conservatizing pull. And certainly in the case of the emergency, the middle class, though we like to think that the middle class opposed the emergency, the middle class by and large supported the emergency at the beginning at least, in the 1975 emergency in India, the middle class supported Hindutva, again, it's the sort of stability, law and order issues. So the question really is it because, do you agree that because the middle class is, as Yogendra Yadav says, not the middle class at all, but it's just another word for the bourgeoisie? Or do you think there's something specific to the sociological category middle class, which gives it its a middle class identity, which gives it its attraction to stability, law and order? So is it attracted to middle, the question is it attracted to stability projects because of something specific to the sociological category of being middle class, or simply because it's the blue person? That's a
real quick. I want a clarification for Patrick. I mean, or just the idea of conversion, is that your concept? Is that
no? It's Bourdieu.
Okay, so I've got to just look at that. I'm learning.
No, but I'll take credit.
But so my two questions are. Just to put it out there as we're wrapping it up. I mean, should we be talking about a middle class? I mean, it seems to me what we're gradually talking about now, since with this the conversion paradigm, which I found very fascinating, is this idea of shared interests and basically to classify them as either winners of globalization and losers of globalization in this new global economy. And what you see is a convergence of interests across class boundaries. For example, if you just think about, at least the way I've been thinking about the Arab world, and I think Nohan and Ava can also comment on this, is that you have poor people who are educated, who really believe if the Middle East is to attract more foreign direct investment or the expansion of the private sector, they stand to benefit, although they're poor. You have a small or petite business class that also stands to benefit from more globalization. And then you have the classic middle class, upper class people who also stand to benefit. Now what's happened is that you have this convergence of interest as, you know, on the whole idea of winners or would-be winners of globalization if it goes right, but they don't necessarily form the necessary alliances domestically. So it's kind of interesting. You don't see, and I don't think it's about political repression. I think this is a story about why aren't the alliances kind of forming along these so-called, you know, winner and loser cleavages. So that's one question. But my other question for the discussion on Egypt is the thing that I'm fascinated by Egypt, and I know Sarah is as well, is this whole the spatial issue, right? Now you have New Cairo in Egypt. And so the middle class is no longer contesting the state for more rights and opportunities. They're now invested in moving to New Cairo, making sure they're not part of the old Cairo. And I just don't understand this personally, like sociologically, politically, I don't know the political consequences. I find this an experiment in the making. If I could spend a year in New Cairo to figure out what's happening, I'd love to do that. I don't think any institution would let me do that right now, but it's, and I'd like to get your sense on what's going on there with this idea of the middle class.
I'm actually next on my list, and it's the false. I kind of two-finger thing in there anyway. I want to, Patrick, I want to push you on this convergence, because I think that Amani's point about the
conversion or convergence?
Convergence.
Different.
That's different.
Yeah. Conversion.
I was thinking about conversion strategies.
Yeah.
I wasn't a
scientist. Oh, conversion strategies. No, but
I'm talking about
convergence.
Yes.
Convergence.
Okay.
I'm going to push one that. It's on the thinking about the interests of the past. And I think you're making a claim about.
Wait. Sorry, Dave, you don't need it.
There's a lack of convergence here.
The end of the conference, I couldn't possibly maintain order. The parallels that you're drawing between India and South Africa worry me because I think it's obscuring some crucial differences in the way the middle class defines or could define its interest. In particular, I think it's worth remembering what Ava said about resource-dependent countries and what that means. I think in the current crisis, the extent to which the South African upper class is dependent on the state to protect it is going to be huge because of the collapse of commodity prices. And what you're going to see is that some of that withdrawal into armed fortresses in what I would call leafy suburbs rather than greenfield suburbs, because greenfield denotes something different. But I think that just means the long term. But I think that some of this is about the extent to which the upper class is willing to spend taxes to subsidize better policing for the entire city. So they'd rather pay for a gated community than pay higher taxes, because they see their destiny as overseas, ultimately. And that's a very different dynamic than what's going on in India, I think. You know, so I just want you to think about this. I think at the end, you risk mushing things together in ways that don't clarify the political project.
Yeah, we're going to take like four more, and then let you guys end in.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. So this is a great panel. I think the different answers on the connection to politics, I would say, go back to this issue of the different definitions of class. Further, go back, I think, most pointed out by Patrick, in the question of what is the connection of class to the economy. And as Amani's question brought up, class as an interest group, are there shared interests? I would put it more succinctly as the class is an identity group, what is its economy. And Eva's provocative presentation, which made a general argument about the lack of relationship between middle class and democracy or democratization specifically, let me argue with that a little bit by getting back to this issue of the relationship of class, the middle class, to the economy. And here, not to repeat what I said yesterday, but I think just a little bit of comparison with ethnicity is important here, or instructive here, in that just as we couldn't really conceive of the nationalist movement without a connection to ethnicity, so there's clearly a connection there. There's clearly a connection between class and the economy. Nobody would make a general determinist argument about if you had some kind of ethnicity, you'll have this kind of political nationalist movement, right? So to de-link a general trajectory from class is not to say, not to go too postmodern on us and say, oh, class is any old thing, it's no connection to the economy, but just that the economy will generate certain kinds of economic interests that may turn into identity-based groups, may get social identities, middle classes, specific varieties, specific interests, but that's not going to be the same in every place, and there's not going to be the same political outcome. So just, for example, a couple of things. The globalized economy, what does that mean? It seems to me a lot of this talk about, in Patrick's presentation in particular, this kind of highlights Eric Olin-Wright's contradictory class position. You have now more ambiguity in terms of the interests that are generated from a particular position in the economy. It's increasingly less likely that a specific occupational category will generate the same economic interests across countries. So teachers may be teachers in different countries, but their political and economic interests as teachers may differ. So the Lipset story of one, you know, teachers leading to one kind of outcome, I think is completely wrong. The same with the state. The discussion of the state and its relationship to civil society, the state and its relationship to supporting or not supporting the middle class, developing or not. Again, if you think of nationalist movements, states are incredibly important in nationalist movements, but they don't play the same role in all nationalist movements across all countries. So I think we can still make an argument. So I want to say we can still make an argument about class and its relationship to politics, but it's likely in a globalized economy, in a world in which states and civil societies are made, it's very likely to be not the same thing in every country. So that is to say, it's not that class doesn't matter for politics or class doesn't matter for democracy, but middle classes in different places would probably have a different kind of relationship to any kind of political outcome that we care about.
But then how is it a predictive, useful analytic category? If it's
not
predictive in consistent ways, if each country has a different story, then that's great for historians, but it's not useful for political scientists.
I don't think so. In social science, there is no single universe of any concept in social science.
Yeah.
State, working class, culture, you can't say that it will produce the same thing. You're the one that said it. I love your point about analytics. It's an analytic entry point, but it doesn't tell you.
Yeah, I mean, it's like saying...
I tell you something. You can't say
ethnicity doesn't matter for politics because it doesn't have the same effect.
Yeah, everything will be different.
But is this the precise point? Is the middle class still a useful analytical category as it was 10, 20, 30 years ago? I mean, that's
never was a useful analytical category. It's really useful.
This is sort of my conclusion from this conference. It's been so interesting, but I have not been persuaded that this is a useful analytic category at all. And I am persuaded by some of you who said, let's look at particular tranches of the middle class, and let's be more specific, and that might be useful. But talking about the middle class writ large is useless.
Which variables in political science, and I'm not sure if this science, have a predictive part?
What political scientists say.
I like you in a graduate of the Department of Politics, which I like to tell my students all the time, not political science.
But then most of our variables will be made because predictive are most variables is actually a good question. On that point,
okay, very quickly, because everybody else has jumped in, but then we're returning to my list.
You know, it's not about predictability, but enterprise we are involved in is about portable expectations.
Okay.
Good. Right? So if I look at South Africa or India, what is it that allows me to have some expectation about other countries? Right? So so that's what we want, right? So we don't want the sort of, mini stories which are completely different, but there is something generalizing about this which we should care about.
Well, I mean, it was a wonderful panel. This is a great conversation. I would try to, I want to throw out a couple of remarks. To General One, I think that the point here is that it's not the middle class, it's middle classes, which is what we've been talking about. So even analytically, I think it's important for us to move beyond the language of the middle class, which was never shown to do one thing anywhere, any place. Even Lipset himself, if you looked, even if you looked at, Barrington Moore, I mean, you could find different ways in which they were using one concept to talk about different groups. I think it's really important here to just throw away any sense that we are talking about a single set of actors across countries. Even if we'd say we use the concept of clerk or manager, professional, they'd be different in different places. But I think the challenge is to look at the variety of subsectors that we meet that are relevant in certain times and places and understand their relationship to each other and to other classes. And we can use the concept of middle classes as a first analytic point to get into that, but then it's the historical and political work of subdividing them. And what I really loved about this panel, a couple things, and particularly your maps, Patrick, because you did a much better job of bringing space home than I did yesterday, is what we're doing in this conference is then adding to our analytic toolkit a repertoire of other things that we're looking at besides middle classes. That's number one. Second is spatial distribution. I think it's really important if we take seriously urbanization as part of the phenomenon. And so another one that came through in this panel today and yours is race or ethnicity. Those are other sets of things that are part of the repertoire of laying out, this is what the challenge is, I think, of this conference. What in the modern world, what are the analytic repertoires that we need to understand relationships and middle class? The second thing that I would just say that was very powerful about the presentations, I know I sound like a one-trick pony here, but is this question of the politics. The only reason I think that we care about middle classes is not because we want to devolve into a discussion of defining them, how you cut them up in different places, but does that tell us something about the world that we're living in? And I think most people here are interested in the political element, although I happen to be interested in the developmental. I wouldn't want to separate politics or democracy from progressive well-being, so I really like your point. And I think that the field, the discipline needs more work on the new political projects and not being constrained, just as I don't think we want to be constrained by the middle class, by the concept of democracy. Because I think that that's where I very appreciate your focus on progressive well-being, because there are going to be different political projects in different places. After all, democracy is not the same thing every place anyway. So why, we don't throw out that word, but we know it's different every place. And think about what are those new politics. And I think that your concept, Patrick, of contractual patronage or patronage politics is a very provocative and interesting one to think about in the developed world. I bet it holds true for Egypt. So I'm not talking about just Latin America, India. I don't know where China would fit in. But this idea of new forms of political relationships that are neither really democracy nor non-democracy, we need to theorize what they are, rather than using those old concepts. And I think that the middle classes and the kind of relationship, their organizational relationship to the state is different, and that we can understand them either spatially or other ways. Finally, this is again Jagore's comment about sovereignty, which I've been pushing. I'm thinking that at minimum we want to throw out the concept of democracy and think about state formation. What are these forms of relationships between state and their constituents, whether it's through patronage, whether it's just through elections, whether it's through governance policy, that's one thing. really go beyond democracy, and second, bring in the transnational or the sovereignty question. Just finally about that, what I think is so powerful about patronage politics, or contextual patronage, if you think about the role of the UN and the multilateral institutions that have built up these India, Latin America, South Africa, they have built in the process of transitions, political and economic, they have become actors that have built civil society, and they created, helped create classes. So it's not just national struggles, but transnational struggles. And then that leaves a question about what is the value of a national sovereignty to understand new politics. So some of the kind of institutional underpinnings of those new, let's say, contractual patronage are transnational. They're not national. If you pulled all the donors out, where would these places be, and what would be politics look like? Where would those middle classes be, and what would politics look like? So I think that's, to me, the fascinating point that came through in this final panel and the last 2 days is rethinking the kind of state-society franchises and what that kind of character, the political underpinnings, and moving beyond old ideas like concepts that are constraining and not enabling, whether it's middle class or democracy.
Okay, did that show you?
I think I share your skepticism about this sort of thing of about to use a broad generalization about middle class democracy. In some ways, I think you build a straw man there, precisely because you're constructing so broad. Whereas I think if you either take Patrick's point of view about the contingent of middle classes, or Tyre's view about middle classes, and I, in particular, think the two aspects of the middle class, or middle particular aspects, are especially important. One is, as Sir Shemmer said, the sort of education. But the other is also its source of income. So the same highly educated consultant, but if it is part of a patronage thing of the state, will not have enough economies for it, right? Whereas if you are, you know, in a private sector firm or you are a university professor in a private university, it's a more autonomous way. I think the autonomous source of income, especially autonomous from the state, which is why a middle class that is formed largely or is part created by state-owned enterprises or public bureaucracy, is probably less likely to have an autonomous, act as an autonomous social force than a middle class which is not state-dependent on its income. Even if in controlling it. I think that's the sort of thing that I think you might see a greater potential. I mean, one of the things, for instance, and a sort of related point on which you made about ideas, I think you underweight in two ways. One is, I think middle class, it's sort of hegemonic role, both as a generator of ideas, but especially as the media becomes a much more bigger part of lives, the sort of jacking classes. That is also what one might call it. And what's interesting is if you look, I mean, because the book I've just finished, I looked at this, if you look at India's sort of freedom struggle, all the key freedoms, if you just look at income tech levels, right, they were probably definitely in the top 1%. Nehru, Gandhi, the family background, Patel and Ambedkar, the four giants of India's. But they were all professional lawyers. You know, the source of income was a lot more to honor. And in fact, they had, Nehru and Gandhi had okay track records. The other two had stellar academic records. I mean, Ambedkar had, you know, PhD from Columbia Economics under John Dewey and a law degree from LSE. I mean, you know, this is 1916. To have that sort of thing is, and coming from a Dalit background, I mean, it's pretty remarkable. And in that sense, I virtually nothing in that thing could show that material interest drove. It is impossible to construct a thing that Gandhi would take the lifestyle he chose for material interest and go for the sort of things. I mean, you can always build that and imagine that, but virtually nothing. In fact, the paradox of India's democracy is that the elite created universal franchise, but virtually few countries did, when it virtually inevitably meant the demise of that very elite. And if that was not driven by ideas, I don't know what you can ever show is driven by ideas. I mean, I just put that up. On a point which Patrick sort of is, you know, which is about this thing of the anxiety for the middle class. And just sort of a few thoughts there. One is it is interesting to argue when Hansen sort of writes that he's like, you know, the BJP peaks out in a few years. By and large, last, whatever, 2003 is probably its peak, and as the new election, 2004, it's peak. And I wonder how one could understand that. I mean, is it that it's more self-confident, and therefore it doesn't need this, right? I mean, one, there is some work which asks whether globalization leads to greater anxieties, and that might indicate why middle classes are more prone to so the links with our religion and so on as one way that gives them some stability of the personal life. But I wonder how one would sort of see the women's here. And I just want to end with this bit of a tongue-in-cheek question. So you had a nice comment saying that all these the phase in the Middle East, that you know, the old dank ones, the men leer over there, but presumably in the Starbucks ones, the men don't leer. And I wonder if that's an indication why you think that's the case.
Why you think that's the case?
Yeah, and is that also an indication of middle class anxiety that only in dark the face men leer, but in Starbucks they don't?
That's a different kind of leering.
That's right.
It's a more sophisticated type of leering.
So I'm going to ask you one more. Say something, then I'm going to...
Yeah,
no, there's time.
One specific question for the presenters and the general public. Kiva, I want to know if you really believe what you are, or what you believe about it. I asked this for the following reason. In the first half of your talk, you develop your skepticism that middle class do not play a democratic role. In the second half of your presentation, you worried about that the Middle East doesn't really have a robust middle class. It's as if you were wishing that this middle class was there and it would do something which it is supposed to do, which is make these societies better, whether it's democratic or more livable or progressive social development. So you were simultaneously skeptical and sort of wanting this beast to arrive on the scene, you know? And I wonder which one is your heart really close to? Sort of, do you believe in the end that if there was a real middle class in the Middle East, there would be no difference? Because that's the thrust of your first half. That it doesn't matter if they get a middle class, it's not going to make a difference. I don't think you believe that. So I want you to kind of spell out. And that's something you can comment on as well, because it addresses your side of the story as well. Patrick, I like what he said a lot. The only comment I have is that on the production side, you were creating this image of decentralizing commodity chains, and globalization somehow has a life of its own. You know, but there is a sort of growing financial hegemony which sort of controls all of this. So, you know, and sort of, American state plays a very important role in managing this hegemony. So it's not as decentralized. The state and capital, finance, capital alliance at the top gives the system a lot more coherence. And I don't know how that plays out itself into sort of life of the middle class and how they get integrated. But this, we should shy away from this decentralized, self-managed idea of globalization, which creates a very different idea of how middle classes fit in, versus a much more managed change system. And so,
middle
classes today. A general comment. I've learned a lot in this conference, all right? And this is a suggestion for those of you who might consider a volume out of this as a comment. You know, sort of, when I have a couple of things I had not thought about, because I have not been working on this issue at all, is how the middle class has been changing, how it sort of has changed over time, how it varies across space, and how to think about political implications in that context. Very
very interesting categories over time emerged. So it seems like middle class begins in developing countries under the shadow of landed classes or in their alliance with colonialism. And so we get the lawyers who lead nationalist movements, or we get the initial sort of middle class, even in your presentation on Eastern Europe, this book-loving culture, which comes from the landed sort of aristocratic background. So there's an early middle class.